Welcome. Good morning. My name is Tom Phillips, and welcome to the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Manhattan. I have a few. I direct your attention to the program for today, and there are announcements about the potluck picnic later this month, the musicale later this month, and other announcements there. Today, we're very happy to have a guest minister. Jen Gray is her first time here to UUFM, but she's not a stranger to Kansas. She actually grew up in Topeka and is a member of the Unitarian congregation in Topeka. She went to college at Emporia State University here in Kansas, and she attended and graduated from the Andover Newton Seminary in Newton, Mass., a UCC affiliate. She's done one internship in California and is off for another one in Ottawa, Canada, later this year. She will be giving the sermon and the program for today related to race and justice in America. So we look forward to hearing from Jen. Let's see. At this point, we will have the chalice lighting, and Jen will lead to that.
We light this chalice by Deborah Falk. We light this chalice, symbolic of the warmth of community and the brightness that love brings to the world, illuminating our search for justice and peace, light, that force that nurtures all living things. Here in our midst, in this flame, so tiny and so significant.
Thank you, Jen. Okay, this is our time for joys and concerns. I believe Kathleen has the microphone. Anything anybody would like to share? Bryce Hobrock.
Thank you. This is Bryce Hobrock. Very pleased to have our daughter Gretchen Garino from Buffalo, New York, with us this morning, and her two children, Samantha, who is with us here, and Jack, who will be 4 years old next month down the hall in the nursery, enjoying himself at this point. So very pleased to have him with us today.
Thank you. Welcome.
Ann Marchin, I just want to thank, and I'm not even sure who to thank. I don't know if it was Lori or Meliz, or Barbara, but anyway, someone got organized to get us to Kansas City to see the Frida Kahlo exhibit at the Nelson, and it was just a wonderful time. Jane rode all the way back with my granddaughter Lucy and kept her entertained very well, and my granddaughter and my grandson and my daughter Melissa and her husband spent the weekend with me, which was great. And the river's up, so that's all my joy. So.
Exactly.
The river's up. Okay. Well, Sabrina Boker, my brother is still looking for work, so hopefully he can find a job soon. And my friend Daisuke over in Japan is also looking for work. Mm. So hopefully, just keep them in their thoughts. Thank you.
Thanks, Sabrina.
Michael Littlefather, I just spent 4 days in Dallas with the Unitarian Universalist Musicians Network, some 230 people who play the piano and organ, direct choirs, and sing in choirs, and do all others, and compose music specifically aimed at us, and it was a great experience singing hymns at the worship service with 200 people who know how to sing and like to sing. Was a great experience, and then our concert of Sunday morning was just an unbelievable experience. Glad to be home.
I have a joy on Friday that it was Kids Night In, and on Kids Night In that we watched Ariel.
All right. Okay, Kathleen has some caring committee announcements.
I have announcements about a few of our members, and thought I'd, no particular order here, I guess, but Les Frazier is home. He's back in Bramlage house at Meadowlark, and they've been able to find no help for his pain, and he has severe pain in the back. So if any of you are friends with him or have a relationship, he would, I'm sure, enjoy a visit or a card or something at Bramlage at Meadowlark. Jim Mitchell has made a move from the health care back to assisted living, so that's a plus. Florence Schwab, who had a mild stroke a couple weeks ago, moved back to Meadowlark to Bramlage House for a kind of a rehab period, and then uncertain where she'll go next. She's doing pretty well. And our member Tom Park, who is Katie Kingery Page. Dad, who's a member here, Tom, he came here late in his life to be near Katie. He's in Meadowlark, and he's in the process of dying right now, and Katie's spending quite a bit of time with him. So Katie is a board member now here at UUFM, so Tom brought Katie. And then last, Marissa Larson's sister, who had breast cancer, died this morning. And Marissa sent just a little bit about her sister, Teresa Larson, grew up in Hiawatha, graduated from K-State with a degree in journalism. She lived in Potomac, Maryland, Potomac, Washington, D.C. area, and is survived by her husband, two daughters, 17 and 12, her parents, four siblings, seven nieces and nephews. And the funeral will be Wednesday, and Jake and Marissa will stay for that and then come home Friday, she thought. So she wanted everybody to know.
Thank you, Kathleen. Okay, if those of us can all stand as you're able and join us in the opening hymn, 1018 from the teal hymnal, that's the bluish-green hymnal, Come and Go With Me, led by our music committee.
I put hymnals on the aisle to distribute through the row, and if you can't find one, we'll give you a minute to locate one, send one down to people so that you can look at it. There might be some over here that need it. I think this is the first time we've ever sung this, and so we will just do our best and get as many of the notes and words as we can and get to know it, because it's a great opener for services, and I'm sure we'll use it again. Okay.
Land. Come and go with me to that land. Come and go with me to that land where I'm bound. Come and go with me to that land. Come and go with me to that land. Come and go with me to that land where I'm bound. There'll be freedom in that land. There'll be freedom in that land. There'll be freedom in that land where I'm bound. There'll be freedom in that land. There'll be freedom in that land. There'll be freedom in that land where I'm bound. Where I'm bound. There'll be justice in that land. There'll be justice in that land. There'll be justice in that land where I'm bound. There'll be justice in that land. There'll be justice in that land. There'll be justice in that land where I'm bound. There'll be singing in that land. There'll be singing in that land. There'll be singing in that land where I'm bound. There'll be singing in that land. There'll be singing in that land. There'll be singing in that land.
Jen will lead the story for all ages.
I'd like to invite children of all ages to come forward. So I want to tell you just a little bit about a very brave little girl named Ruby Bridges. Do any of you know who Ruby Bridges is? Yeah? Excellent. So who knows what segregation means? Any of you? Well, a long time ago, before any of you were born, there was a time when our schools were segregated. So children with different skin colors couldn't go to the same school, which seems kind of silly, doesn't it? So they passed a law saying that that wasn't fair because people were getting treated differently and it wasn't fair. Everybody should have access to the same education. And this little girl who was 6 years old named Ruby Bridges, she was the very first African-American little girl to go to an all-white school. And she went by herself. Like, she was the only kid to go. And some of the adults were so angry and they were so scared of this change that they would yell at her. So marshals, like police, went with her every day, walked her to school. And the classroom that she was supposed to have, some of the teachers took their kids out. Or not the teachers, the parents took their kids out. So she went to class all by herself for a whole year, which means she got just her and the teacher for a whole year. That can be fun. Can't get away with much, though. So what is really important about this story, I think, is both that Ruby was very, very brave to do this hard thing, to go to this school and to be the first one, but also she didn't do it alone. Like, she worked for justice in the world, but there were teachers that were helping, her parents were helping, there were lots of people that wanted there to be justice in the world. And that's how it is today, too. There's lots of things that, as Unitarian Universalists, we work on, and we want to improve in the world, but we don't ever have to do it alone. Are you guys ready for your classes?
Okay, before the offertory, I have this reading related to Jen's presentation. Michelle Alexander's recent book, The New Jim Crow, picks up the old tale told by slavery by another name, as Michelle writes in her eloquent opening paragraph. Jarvis Cotton cannot vote. Like his father, grandfather, great-grandfather, and great-great-grandfather, he has been denied the right to participate in our electoral democracy. Cotton's family tree tells the story of several generations of black men who were born in the United States, but who were denied the most basic freedom that democracy promises, the freedom to vote for those who will make the rules and laws that govern one's life. Cotton's great-great-grandfather could not vote as a slave. His great-grandfather was beaten to death by the Ku Klux Klan for attempting to vote. His grandfather was prevented from voting by Klan intimidation. His father was barred from voting by poll taxes and literacy tests. Today, Jarvis Cotton cannot vote because he, like many black men in the United States, has been labeled a felon and is currently on parole. She goes on to write, "An extraordinary percentage of black men in the United States are legally barred from voting today, just as they have been throughout most of American history. Today's disenfranchisement of African-American men has come about through a system that is formerly colorblind, the criminal justice system. In the era of colorblindness, it is no longer socially permissible to use race explicitly as a justification for discrimination, exclusion, and social contempt. So we don't. Rather than rely on race, we use our criminal justice system to label people of color criminals, and then engage in all the practices we supposedly left behind with Jim Crow. Today, it is perfectly legal to discriminate against criminals in nearly all the ways that it was once legal to discriminate against African Americans.
There are two dolls. One is black and the other white. And they're placed in front of a little girl of about 5 or 6. She is an adorable child with her hair up and a dark complexion. This little girl is participating in a reproduction of an experiment done for the Brown versus Board of Education case. And it's shown as a part of a video called A Girl Like Me, which you can find on YouTube. The interviewer asks several children these questions. Which doll do you like the best? This little girl picks up the white doll and says, this one. And the interviewer asks, can you show me the nice doll? She picks up the white doll again, smiling. Why is that the nice doll? She's white, the little girl responds. Can you show me the doll that looks bad? She picks up the black doll. Why is she bad? The little girl responds in a smaller voice. She's black. And the final question, the heartbreaking question, can you show me the doll that looks like you? And the little girl reaches towards the white doll and hesitates, and then pushes the black doll towards the interviewer and away from herself. 15 of the 21 participating black children picked the white doll when asked which one they liked best or would want to play with. And this is only one of the painful examples of the damage racism does in our country. Institutional racism is woven tightly into the fabric of this land of the free and home of the brave, and it shows up in many areas. Michelle Alexander quotes Iris Myron Young, a theorist, using the metaphor of a birdcage. If one thinks about racism by examining only one wire of the cage, or one form of disadvantage, It is difficult to understand how and why the bird is trapped. Only a large number of wires arranged in a specific way and connected to one another serve to enclose the bird and to ensure that it cannot escape. Racism, and in particular racism in our criminal justice system, have reemerged as a part of our national conversation after the recent acquittal of George Zimmerman for the death of Trayvon Martin. It is difficult to avoid the idea in that case that Trayvon Martin would still be alive if he had been white. If he had been a white teen walking through that area on his phone, would Zimmerman have felt compelled to follow him? Would he have said, "These punks always get away"? Would he have labeled Trayvon a criminal? And this label is one often experienced by young black men in this country. They report women crossing the street or clutching their purse when they walk past. They report being followed in stores, and evidence shows that black men in particular are often discriminated against in job searches. And the list goes on. The situation is serious enough that black parents routinely coach their children on how to behave when they walk into a store or when faced by cops. LeVar Burton, an actor who played Geordi on Star Trek and also did Reading Rainbow for your non-geeks out there, was recently talking on CNN about the process he goes through when stopped by cops. He talked about he takes off his sunglasses, puts it in the seat next to him, takes off his hat, puts it in the seat next to him, puts his hands out the window, and he tells his children that they need to do the same. After the trial, black parents across the country talked of feeling an increase of fear that was already present for their sons. Tim Wise, a white anti-racist educator and activist, says that if we can understand what it means for black parents to have to tell their children to keep their hands at 10 and 2 if pulled over by the cops, or to state that they are reaching for their wallet before they do it, white folks need to understand the fundamental difference between being black and being white and trying to raise our children to healthy adulthood. Understanding the difference in experience is essential, and it can be heartbreaking. Craig Futterman, a law professor at the University of Chicago, reports the experience of one of his law students on a ride along with the Chicago police. Every time we drove into a public housing project and stopped the car, every young black man in the area would almost reflexively place his hands up against the car and spread his legs to be searched, and the officers would search them. The officers would then get back in the car and stop in another project, and this would happen again. I couldn't believe it. It just seemed so normal for the police and the young men. This all comes from Michelle Alexander's powerful and very disturbing book, The New Jim Crow: Mass Incarceration in an Age of Color Blindness. Michelle is a civil rights lawyer, advocate, and a legal scholar who puts forth the idea that the war on drugs this country has been waging since the 1980s is little more than a new system of Jim Crow, a way to keep a significant portion of the black population of this country regulated to a lower caste. How many of you have read this book? Okay, good. You'll be surprised by the sermon then. When we look at the history of Jim Crow laws in the 1960s, it wasn't difficult to see that folks who were black were regulated to a lower caste, were treated differently. We had school segregation. They were prevented from voting by poll tax and laws that allowed poll workers to administer nearly impossible tests. They were subject to discrimination in employment, housing, education, and were routinely denied the right to serve on a jury. In fact, some states adopted laws that made it illegal not to have a job. Thus, when they found African Americans who were not working, they were arrested and then hired out to plantation owners and companies. When I went to school, all of these realities and racism in general were taught to us as though they belonged in the past. I was taught that we are an equal society, a colorblind society. Like Mr. Cotton in our reading today, a shocking percentage of young black men cannot vote. They endure legalized discrimination that allows them to be denied housing, jobs, the right to serve on a jury, and many other things. Does that sound familiar? It sounds like the other list. Michelle Alexander states that the war on drugs is an adaptation of the previous system, designed to keep folks of color under control. And although in some ways it is worse, during Jim Crow, folks had a measure of freedom. They could at least go home to their families at night. Mass incarceration takes away even that. The Human Rights Watch report from the year 2000 indicates that in 7 states, African Americans constitute 80 to 90% of all drug offenders sent to prison. In at least 15 states, black folks are admitted to prison on drug charges at a rate 20 to 57 times greater than that of white men. In large cities, upon which the drug war is focused, as many as 80% of young African American men now have criminal records. There's the argument on one side that this makes sense. People who feel this way say that black men are using drugs at a much higher rate than white folks, so they're getting arrested at a higher rate. In fact, Alexander states that studies show that when asked to picture a drug criminal, people almost always picture someone who is black. So that's our national mindset. However, the numbers actually show us something very different. Reverend Amy Zucker Morgenstern says it well. She says, "What I thought before was that black people use and sell drugs at a rate disproportionate to their numbers in the population. Sure, there's racism in the criminal justice system, but one reason the prison population is disproportionately black is that African Americans commit a larger percentage of crime." And she says, "What I think now, black and white people use and sell drugs at about the same rate." The National Institute of Drug Abuse reports of its studies of secondary school students, contrary to the popular assumption, at all 3 grade levels, African American students have sustained substantially lower rates of use of most illicit and licit drugs than do white students. These include illicit drug use, most of the specific illicit drugs, alcohol and cigarettes. Contrary to popular assumption, Amy says, has to be the biggest understatement of the year. Why was this report not the top story of every newspaper in the country? And activist Tim Wise agrees. He states, "According to the National Institutes on Drug Abuse, the Centers for Disease Control and the Department of Health and Human Services, whites are equally or more likely to use drugs than their African American counterparts, despite common misperceptions to the contrary." So if the drug use is about the same, what leads to such dramatic differences in incarceration rates? Michelle Alexander highlights a series of cases that ended up in the Supreme Court, and which supported or created a system that not only allowed discriminatory practices and searches, seizures of property, and but also took away individual rights to fight against them in the court system. An example of this was Florida v. Bostick. Terrence Bostick was on a Greyhound bus when officers searched it looking for people that might be carrying drugs. He was asleep when they woke him. They showed badges and a gun, and when they asked him for identification, he complied. When they asked to be allowed to search his bag, he agreed, which resulted in his arrest. He was carrying cocaine. The Supreme Court decided that a reasonable person would have known they didn't have to consent to the search. Therefore, it didn't violate the Fourth Amendment prohibition against unreasonable search and seizure. I can't help but think back to all of those parents telling their children that they have to behave in a certain way around cops. Police are also given a broad range of discretion about who to pull over and when, even for a minor traffic violation. Police in many situations can then ask for permission to search, and if it is granted, they can then search a car for drugs when the encounter started with someone who didn't use a turn signal. Alexander provides a preponderance of evidence that shows us African Americans are several times more likely to be pulled over and end up arrested for having drugs. Once in the system, they are more likely than white people arrested for the same crime to end up in jail or on probation. Over and over again, the statistics show us that African Americans and whites who go through the system for the same crime get different sentences. So let's return to Reverend Zucker Morgenstein's processing of this book. Her words, "What I thought before. Racism is present in the criminal justice system the way it is present everywhere. It's a problem that concerns me, but calling it the equivalent of Jim Crow is nothing more than rhetorical flourish. What I think now. The criminal justice system has been pressed into the service of an agenda that has changed form over the years, but has not diminished. The social control of racial minorities, especially African Americans, the means was once Jim Crow. Now it is mass incarceration, which is truly, not just rhetorically, the new Jim Crow. An aspect of our culture that Michelle Alexander highlights as contributing to the problem is the idea of colorblindness in our society. She says, "What has changed since the collapse of Jim Crow has less to do with the basic structure of our society than the language we use to justify it. In the era of colorblindness, it is no longer socially permissible to use race explicitly as a justification for discrimination, exclusion, and social contempt. So we don't. Rather than rely on race, we use our criminal justice system to label people of color as criminals, and then engage in practices we supposedly left behind." I encourage you to read her book if you haven't. This sermon is a little like the movie version of the Harry Potter books. There's just a whole lot that is left out. The new Jim Crow was recommended. This book was recommended by the UUA for the 2012-2013 Common Read. And this is an important issue. It's also an issue that many civil rights activists avoid. They avoid advocating for people who have been labeled criminals. It is easier to stand on the side of innocence. But our faith has never called us to easy things. We share a desire to work for justice in this world, to stand with people who have been marginalized. And we are a people that share a principle of belief in the inherent worth and dignity of every human being. Ours is a faith that calls us to hear the voices that speak of injustice. And we need to hear those stories, even when it is hard, Because as Dr. King says, injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. Laura Hearsay expresses this in her beautiful poem, Telling. What you risk telling your story, you will bore them. Your voice will break, your ink will spill and stain your coat. No one will understand. Their eyes become fences. You will park yourself forever on the outside. Your differentness once and for all revealed. Dangerous. The names you give to yourself will become epithets. Your happiness will be called bravery and denial. Your sadness will justify their pity. Your fears will magnify their fears. Everything you say will prove something about their God or their economic system. Your feelings that change day to day, kaleidoscopic, will freeze in place, brand you forever. Justify anything they decide to do with you. Those with power can afford to tell their story. Someone, somewhere, will hear your story and decide to fight, to live, and refuse to compromise. Someone else will tell her own story, risking everything. Beloved spiritual companions, emboldened by faith, we dare to proclaim we are standing on the side of love. We will sing these words together in just a few minutes, and I invite you to really feel them as you sing them. You are a part of a tradition that has decided to take a stand on the side of love on so many things. You are part of the hope that we have for justice in this world. And it's not easy to hear others' stories, to decide to stand, to tell your own story, to risk everything. This is what we have to offer Trayvon Martin. Ourselves and any person targeted because of the color of their skin. We have the ability to work towards a world where walking down the street in a hoodie does not make a young black man suspicious. Where a little girl can proudly identify with the doll who has the color of skin that is the same as hers. We have that hope. May it be so. Amen. Turned it off.
Don't lose that thought, Ruth. No, come on. Here you go.
Thank you. I live in Meadowlark, and I'm not advocating political parties, but when people talk against Obama, they talk about him in a different way than they would ever talk about another kind of a white president. They scoff. They say he doesn't know what he's doing. It's the kind of language they use to express their disapproval.
Yeah. Yeah, I had a family member who, when he got elected, was worried that they were taking over. I said they're taking over. And I said, I can't talk to you right now.
I'm Elke Lorenz. I have a very radical thought with regard to the National Rifle Association, who is so animate against the restriction of weapons. I think it's a form of racism because they want to continue that black youth shoot each other because they are often in the neighborhoods where these weapons are used, and so that's why they are so animate against curbing weapons that can do a lot of damage. So I think it's a form of racism in that group.
This is Bryce. Again, I'd like to continue that thought. Elka's just begun here. I think stand your ground laws and concealed carry laws, et cetera, are also a form of new Jim Crow and racism. Because where is the NRA when it comes to the debate, why aren't we arming all black people as well to defend themselves against whites or whatever? And think about it a minute. There's a large irony in this, and a great hypocrisy for the NRA to not be advocating guns for everyone. It's guns for whites. It's not guns for blacks. So how soon will it be before we see a lawsuit brought that all these gun laws are discriminatory against blacks?
Heard any talk of that. That's an, yeah, that's a perspective I hadn't considered.
Did you? Yeah, okay. These, some of these are metaphorical questions, I guess. Okay, NRA and racism.
I'm going to change subjects. Jessica, I never saw it on television, but it went around the internet, the Cheerios commercial.
Yeah.
And I'm kind of surprised you didn't mention it, but if anybody hasn't seen it, it depicts a beautiful mixed race child, and she goes to the kitchen and she says to her mother, who is a white woman, this says Cheerios are good for your heart. And she's like, that's right, sweetie. So she runs into the living room where her African American father is sleeping on the couch, and she dumps it on top of his chest. And he wakes up and he's like, what's going on? Well, the little girl's thinking, you know, if Cheerios are good for the heart, then she'll give her dad some Cheerios on top of his heart, on his chest. And so I believe they must have, you know, yanked the commercial after having... They didn't.
No, they very clearly took a stand. They're like, the response to this is stupid. We're not pulling the commercial.
Okay.
Yeah, because the response was vicious.
I don't know if they had they'd done different takes on this where they just thought they'd stir the pot a little more, and there were two mothers in the situation.
I hadn't heard that.
And I don't know if that got published, but maybe a different company made it. But I think good for them, you know. And... they took the video, the original video of the mixed race couple, and they showed it to a bunch of children, and they told the children, there's something about this video you're about to watch, this commercial, that adults are very upset about. And they asked the children after it was over, you know, what do you think it was? And they're like, I have no idea. And they thought that this was ridiculous, which I'm encouraged by. So that was my little part of discussion.
Yeah, that was... That was a great commercial, and the response to it, I mean, some of the responses to it was just vicious.
Hi, I'm Kim Waldheim. I just wanted to, I think you made the point, but I just wanted to kind of reiterate that the whole idea of color blindness is dangerous.
Absolutely.
We need to be color fluid rather than color blind. Color blindness is a way to bury the whole idea of race. If we're colorblind, we don't talk about it, and all of this stuff can go on underneath, which was, I think, what you were saying.
Mm-hmm.
I work in the area of diversity training, and I have done diversity training with people of color who are just as colorblind as white people. It's a social message that everybody gets, that we're supposed to be colorblind. It's really rampant in the military, which, and this is a military town, although I think they do some really good work. I've been learning about some of the work that they do. But I think we need to concentrate more on being color fluid and allowing people to have anger over. I mean, there's this whole idea of the angry black man, it's dangerous. The angry black woman needs to be dismissed because, you know, she's crazy or whatever. These kinds of social messages are just the same form of racism that keep people's voices down. Thank you.
I completely agree. A colorblind is a very dangerous message. It's dismissive of the reality that people of color and white people have very different experiences in this country. Tim Wise have you guys heard of Tim Wise, aside from just a few minutes ago? He is excellent. He has a book called Colorblind, something like The Politics of Post-Racial America. He also wrote one called Between Obama and a Hard Place. He writes a lot of books about white privilege and really advocates for people to realize what's going on there. But he has essays online, and he talks about the danger of a colorblind society and has a really great essay called What Kind of Card is Race? Because you don't know how many times, I know I've heard that a bunch of times since George Zimmerman was acquitted. It's like, oh, they're pulling the race card. Like, that's an advantage?
Okay. Back in the early 70s, there was a misconception with college students graduating in education, and they heard, well, Australia's the place to go, and they don't have racism over there, and then once they got over there, they realized that the problem was, in fact, there, but just not admitted to.
Mm-hmm. Anybody else? Michael? Barbara?
I've been reading some interesting literature on discrimination and prejudice, and it turns out that there are people in this room who rank higher in terms of negativity, people who are polled and told just one thing about a person, race, age, and that, so they start up, and people who generate a fair amount of animosity, not surprisingly, include gays, Muslims, but the top of the list is reserved for atheists. And so I've been thinking that maybe we atheists could help the African Americans, take some of the load off them, because we're mostly able to defend ourselves, rhetorically, and to do what we can to refocus the country's animosity. If others want to join me in this, I'm willing to bite the bullet for them.
Well, thank you, Michael. Anybody else? Barbara.
I have an African American granddaughter, and after this Martin thing, it went through my head that I'm glad she's a girl, because a young African American boy's, it's a big trouble.
I think a lot of parents and family members have experienced those same thoughts. And it's sad that that shouldn't be the case. I remember I watched, when I was researching for this and other things, I watched a video about a woman who was talking about how she tells her son, when he goes into a store, if he's wearing a hood, he needs to take it off. If he has his hands in his pockets, he needs to take them out. You know, I mean, our children shouldn't have to be coached on how to keep themselves from getting shot.
Well, I just want to comment on Michael's advice or recommendation. Is the trouble is, if you're an atheist, it's too easy to pass.
Can I make a comment?
That's actually a very good point. There is a difference between identities that get discriminated against that aren't easily identifiable and identities that are discriminated against that, you know, you can look at somebody and label them that way. So that's a really good point.
Yeah. Maybe we should all, or you and Michael and others, should wear something that we can identify you with.
A big red A, maybe?
The trouble with the letter A is it could be confusing.
I'm already a head start on you, Michael, because today, while I was waiting for Jim Chanteau to pick me up, there were a bunch of Methodists waiting, too, and their bus came, and one of them said to me, "Look, watch out, Ruth, because you might get mixed up." I said, "I'll never get mixed up."
All right. Anything else? I think this is a subject that we all need to consider more, and unfortunately, things in the news remind us that we're not a perfect society.
Okay.
Well, Jen will be here for more discussion during the coffee hour, and now sure. our closing hymn.
It's one of my favorite topics, yeah. Racism.
The closing hymn is one of several things written by Jason Shelton, who is the minister. He has a degree in theology as well as a graduate degrees in music at the First Unitarian University Church of Nashville. And I think maybe that experience gives him a kind of a distorted view of what congregations can sing. And if you have a 50-voice
choir leading them, many of them paid, all of them there only because they are satisfied, they get through the tryouts to join, and then a congregation full of people from the music industry. And so here's a song. The words are wonderful. And we are going to sing it. And we are going to do our best. And all of you, you know the old joke about Unitarian Universalist congregations being poor singers because they're always reading ahead to see if they want to agree with the words before they will say them. Let me assure you here, there are only one or two that annoy me slightly, and you may find more or none as you work on this. But it's become almost it's replacing Blue Boat Home as our cliche in the music world in our denomination. And I don't think we've tried it yet, but we're going to, and we're all going to do our best. So. Stand in body or spirit, as they say, and we will do our best to keep up with the piano and encourage you to do likewise. And if the words, in the verses are problematic, at least you can get the chorus or most of it. Okay? All right, let's go.
That's first time.
Go in peace, go in love, go into the world and create justice. Amen.